Welcome, everyone, to the 12th live session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. My name is Christy Peoples. I'm a producer here at Sounds True, and I'll be your host. Today, Dr. Luann Brizendine will be teaching on what we know about the female and the male brain. She's broadcasting live from Sausalito, California, while the Sounds True team and I are here in our Boulder studios. A free recording of this session will remain accessible for 24 hours. And if you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, to transcripts from each session, and bonus gifts from our presenters. And now, it's my honor to introduce you to Dr. Luann Brizendine. Luann Brizendine, MD, is a best-selling author, public speaker, and media commentator. She's completed her degree in neurobiology at UC Berkeley, graduated from the Yale School of Medicine, and did her internship and residency at Harvard Medical School. She's also served on both the faculties of Harvard University and the University of California at San Francisco. Dr. Brizendine now holds the Lynn and Mark Benioff Endowed Chair in Clinical Psychiatry at UCSF, where she founded the Women's Mood and Hormone Clinic in 1994. Her New York Times best-selling book, The Female Brain, has been translated into 31 languages, and its follow-up, The Male Brain, into 16 languages. The Female Brain is currently being made into a movie as well. Welcome, Dr. Brizendine.
Thank you all for having me. It's just great to be here and be in this format where I can share with all of you out there some of the studies I've done over the years and sort of how I see the concept of the male and female brain from both a neuroscience, a neuroemotional, neuropsychological, and biological basis. So I thought I would share with you just for a minute before we get started with the actual presentation about how I got into this field. I started in my age 18 to 22 in my undergraduate years at UC Berkeley in a class that was the first class that went into neurobiology as an undergraduate, where we were learning about, at that time, hormone effects on behavior, which I found to be fascinating. At the same time, of course, it was the era of, Ms. Magazine had just come out, so it was really the heyday of the feminist movement and lots of protests and issues of both civil rights and gender rights and equal pay for equal work, ERA rights, which of course didn't pass. So I was very involved in not only the neurobiology, but also in what was going on sort of social politically at Berkeley at that time, and really enjoying the ideas and aspects of how hormones caused urges and triggers for our behavior as kind of a biological substrate of what made us who we are, what made us male and female. And then I went off to Yale Medical School to do medicine. I decided I wanted to go into medicine and go more deeply into human biology and behavior. I can remember a wonderful lecture having one morning where the professor was describing all the aspects of the study he had done, and I raised my hand and said, well, what were the differences in the males and the females? And he said, oh, we don't study the females because their menstrual cycles would just mess up the data. So looking back on that, I was 23 or 24 years old at the time. I thought, oh, dear, no. Of course, you wouldn't want to mess up your data. So that's kind of the attitude of science for about the next 20 years, actually, is you didn't want to mess up your data by studying females because the menstrual cycle would mess up your data. I think it's also an interesting thing that the birth control pills were first tested on male bodies before they ever started testing them on females, which is interesting. So there's lots of aspects of clinical studies that had been done on males, and then those medications were used in females, that has been corrected in the last few years by various kinds of laws Congress has passed to make sure that we do both male and females in clinical studies. So today what I thought I would do is to cover for you all the things that I cover in both of my books, The Female Brain and The Male Brain, in kind of a conceptual way, and get into some of the details of each of those books. Of course, they're very easy to read. You don't need to know much science to read them. So feel free to dive deeper in the books at some point if you would like. So let's start off first here. The first slide, yes, and as it says on my first slide, I'm the director and founder of the Women's and Teen Girls Mood and Hormone Clinic at UCSF, where I see patients that have various kinds of mood issues that are related to hormone fluctuations, and I'll get into some of that in my talk. So, okay, on the next slide, I wanted to present to you the whole outline. So this is what we're going to be going through for the next hour. I'm going to go over some of the birth of the female and male brain and how that all happens. And then after birth, getting into the boy and girl brain. The teen girl brain and the teen boy brain is the next chunk of my talk. And then the male and female mating brain, how males and females approach that part of all of our lives. The male and female sexual brain, I usually don't get interviewed too much on chapter four in both of the books, is on the what called the brain below the belt, because it gets into a great amount of detail sexually. So today I will discuss some of that here with you. Then the mommy brain and the daddy brain, which gets into some areas of the male and female brain and behavior that, of course, is quite different and probably is the largest reason we have male and female. It's because of what happens basically for procreation and the way human beings, since we have babies that are so immature because we are upright and our pelvises can only get a certain amount of head circumference through the pelvis, we have to deliver our babies, our young, at a very, very immature stage, whereas other animals can carry them for longer. So females have to be ready to take care of helpless infants, nonverbal infants, and figure out what they want and need very quickly in order to keep them alive. So those of us who are females that are alive today had our very successful great-great-great-grandmothers that were very good at keeping helpless infants alive. And of course, the daddy brain, the daddies also provide a lot of security and comfort. And we'll talk a little bit about how some changes actually hormonally and structurally happen in the daddy brain. And then we'll end up with the male and female mature brain, which is that stage of life after procreation, and gets into the grandmother and grandfather brain. Okay. On the next slide, let's go into the birth of the male and female brain section. And on the next slide, sexual differentiation begins with conception. So you see on this slide, the sperm is entering the surface of the egg. So if that sperm is carrying an X chromosome, and remember, it only carries one of the sex chromosomes, each sperm. If that sperm is carrying an X, then that baby will be female. That fetus will be female. If it's carrying a Y, it will be male. And remember, the X chromosome has 931 genes on it, whereas the Y chromosome only has 64 genes. So it is a little bit smaller than the female. And we'll get into some of that biology a little bit later. But so at that moment that we're seeing right here in a very magnified view on an electron micrograph, the sperm entering the egg, at that moment, that is the beginning of which sex this fetus is going to be. Okay, so on the next slide, here we have the baby inside the womb, marinating in whatever hormones it has. And if that is a male fetus, the tiny testicles at 8 weeks of life start pumping out huge amounts of testosterone that marinates the brain and body and changes the brain and body to male. If it's female, if it's XX, then this fetus is going to be not marinated in testosterone. We females develop in the womb unperturbed by testosterone, and that's how all of our circuits develop in what is called the default circuits are female, because they don't need the addition of marinating by testosterone that changes many of the circuits and changes, of course, the gonads into male gonads and the brain into male brain. Okay, and then on the next slide, we all pop out having either in the typical version, we end up having a male brain and body or a female brain and body. And of course, we have some various and sundry different ways that that can mix and match and have someone born with more of a male body and a female brain or vice versa. So we may be able to talk about some of that later. I'll be happy to answer some questions about how we think that happens or situations in which that happens. But I want to kind of go through what we think of as a typical heterosexual development of the female and male first, and then we can talk about all kinds of modifications and differences later. Okay, so here we are. Right away, we've popped out, and we are either male or female. And on the next slide, this is just kind of an overview of a slice right through the middle of the brain, where the pink structures, the rose-colored structures here, are structures that end up being in the brain, larger in the female, and the blue ones are structures that are larger in the male. So you can see there are some differences, but it's important to note, of course, that, you know, male and female brains are more alike than they are different. After all, we are the same species. So that's something to always keep in mind when we're talking about the differences. They're small differences. They're differences that are caused by both the genes and the hormones, both during development and throughout our lives. And that's the part that we're going to cover today. Okay, next slide. This is just another view of brain connections, which are now called the connectome maps, and revealing the differences between the male brain that are the ones in blue and the ones that are more in the orange are the female. And so there are many connections that are either stronger or bigger in male brain and female brain that are being elucidated. Like literally every week there's a new paper or a new research study that comes out that is showing what some of these differences are that have to do with connections between different areas of the brain in male and female. Okay, next I wanted to go over how the birth of our brain again, so we kind of can think about, first point is that we all start out with female-type brain circuits. Like I said, the female is nature's default. So this is just the summary of what we talked about earlier, that the female is nature's default pattern. And the second point is that, in summary, that about 8 weeks of fetal life, and then at various points through that 9 months where the baby is cooking away in the uterus, the male, the tiny testicles, start to pump out large amounts of testosterone that marinate those brain circuits, changing it into male brain. One example of the areas that changes that won't be surprising to you is that what's called the area for sexual pursuit is about 2.0 to 2.5 times larger in the male brain. So for you men, that's part of your role. That's how God she made it, so that we can, that you're supposed to go out and search out fertile females. You're in sexual pursuit. That's how we ended up being a successful species on Earth. Okay, that's just an aside. All right, on the next slide, so what it means and why does this even matter to us? It's probably pretty obvious to all of us who live on the planet about what it means and why does it matter. But on the next slide, so the why of the male and female brain. Point one is that basically the two brains are more alike than different, like we talked about, because we are the same species. So that's really important to remember. And we have, you know, all of our circuits are basically more alike than different. But these obvious sex-specific differences that are related to reproduction and parenting. So the big reasons for the why we have male and female are related to how we reproduce, that the male needs to pursue the female needs to attract the male, that's the female's role, and parenting, that for example, female pregnancy and keeping helpless infants alive, like we discussed, are really, they cannot be left to choice. I mean, any of you that have children and have had children, or any of you who have been children, watched children, or helped with children, know that they really need protecting, need their parents, and that keeping them alive and keeping them protected is something that, of course, the human species does, and typically mothers are the primary one that do this thing, and you can't leave it to choice, so that when an infant is very small and being helpless, you can't just, you hear the baby cry, the mother immediately starts to get milk, you know, feeding the baby, responding to the baby's cries is very, very hormonally wired in the female. And we'll talk about that a bit in the mommy brain. And the daddy brain actually has a lot of that that happens as well, especially with his second child. And then, of course, the other difference is male courtship and support of the mother-infant pair being something that's always been a part of the role of males, human males, and also monogamous mammals. There are about 5% of mammals that are monogamous. Some of you may have heard of these little furry guys called the prairie voles, and they mate for life. And both the males and females take care of the young and bring them in and out of the nest and bring them food. The female is the only one, obviously, that lactates and breastfeeds, but the male is bonded for life, and they take care of the pups together. And they've discovered some of the genes in that species that actually make them monogamous and bond. So we may talk about some of that later. Okay, next slide is we're going to look at some of the effects of the sex hormones on the male brain. That conceptually, so before birth, during fetal life, the sex hormones build and organize the brain circuits. The testosterone actually will build the typical male brain circuits that we saw and marinate the whole body and brain in testosterone, which of course the female doesn't have any of. Then after birth, the testosterone in the male makes certain behaviors more likely. They don't make them happen, but they make them more likely to happen. So the behaviors are just right under the surface, and it just takes a tiny trigger to make them happen. For example, the testosterone makes it more likely to increase sex or sexual pursuit or sexual desire in the male, and also male aggression. So that hormone is kind of the key to what we call maleness. Okay, on the next slide, as we discussed, the female brain is left unperturbed by the testosterone in utero. Of course, you know, after puberty, we'll talk about that. Females do get some testosterone, but in the female brain is unperturbed during development in utero by testosterone. And then at birth, we said we either have a male or female brain, and of course that the exceptions are non-conforming gender, the non-functional androgen receptor. So the testosterone or androgen receptor needs to be present in order for the testosterone to act. But one genetic mutation in males that have a Y chromosome, but they have abnormal or a non-functioning testosterone or androgen receptor, which is one way to end up with a female body but a male brain. So that's an example of an exception, which is an androgen receptor non-function, which is a genetic mutation that some people have. Okay, the next slide is one that I want to just use for us to kind of visualize what we've talked about so far and then see where we're going on for the next chunk of things. So let's look together at this. Look at the, I hope it's sort of a greenish area that's in utero, that one big chunk that says trimesters 1, 2, and 3. So this is during pregnancy in utero. The fetus is in utero. And the big jagged line that's going up there is all of the hormones that are marinating this fetus. And then there's at birth, the hormones are very, very high still. And that period of the first year or 2 years, we refer to that as infantile puberty because, look, you can see from this graph how high the sex hormones still are at that period. The male testosterone is still very high. You know, if you've seen baby boys born, when they first come out for the first few months, you know, their testes are, the testicles look huge compared to the rest of the baby's body. So they are really, they're huge because they're so active. They're usually kind of huge and red, and they're pumping out almost adult male levels of testosterone, even up to year one, age 12 months for boys. Then in the little girls, this is the first time by about 1 month old, their ovaries all of a sudden turn on because of a hormonal signal called FSH that turns on the ovaries and makes it start making huge amounts of estrogen, almost adult female levels of estrogen, which this area of human development is not very well studied because it's very hard to study infants at this stage. And other mammals don't have this infantile puberty in quite the same way as we humans do. So up till 2 years old, the females, little girls, are making large amounts of estrogen, sometimes as much almost as adult females. And it's marinating their body and their brain. And we don't really still know, scientists don't know the reason for this or the function of it. The hypothesis is it is basically triggering all the cells in the brain and body to be just ready when puberty hits, to become fertile, and it has to do with being fertile and having the whole behavioral circuitry in the brain for reproductive behavior. So look down at this slide a little bit, where right at about 2 years old through 5 years old through 10 years old, that area we call, the technical name for that time of life is the juvenile pause or the latency phase. In normal language, we call that childhood. That is childhood. And you can see how low the hormone levels are for boys and girls, have very, very small amounts of testosterone and estrogen in that 4 or 5 years leading up to puberty, or 6 or 7 years leading up to puberty, called childhood. So even though we'll talk about the behavioral differences in boys and girls, we know that they're not really being caused particularly by big fluctuations in hormones, because the sex hormones are so low at that stage. So look what happens, though, at about age 10, 9 or 10. That's when the hormones start to ramp way up to the rock and roll of puberty into adolescence. So all of a sudden, during childhood, there's a certain chemical that keeps what's called the brakes on the pituitary, that keeps the pituitary and brain from signaling to the gonads. So you don't make sex hormones from the ovaries or testicles during childhood. But as soon as the brake's taken off, as soon as that chemical is basically released, the brain starts to signal the pituitary, and the pituitary starts to signal the ovaries or the testicles, and the sex hormones take off like a rocket into the rock and roll of puberty. So this is sort of the hormone scenario from conception through adolescence. So let's go to the next slide and take a little bit more look at kind of a summary of the 0 to 3 years that we just talked about, which is, first point is that boys, the 1 month to 9 months is the huge testosterone surge from the testicles. And then, of course, the girls, 1 month to 24 months, the huge estrogen surge from the ovary. And third, just to remind you that that is called infantile puberty, and that's something particular to humans that we scientists still don't know very much about that phase of human development. And finally, fourth point is that there are lots of things that are different that start to happen male-female that are noticed for behavioral differences in male and female. For example, from 0 to 3 months, eye contact, or what's called mutual facial gazing, it increases about 400% in little girls from the day of birth till about 3 months old. But in boys, it doesn't increase at all. It's not that boys don't do it, they do, but the little girls really start to key in on the interaction of the face and the eye contact and mutual facial gazing. Little boys tend to be what they call, they start to watch moving objects around them a little bit more than girls. So there's some very interesting studies of right away how the brain is wired differently in that, and that comes out behaviorally in the first few months of life, which I always find is very interesting. Okay, in the next slide, I just wanted to review the phases of a male's hormonal life, just so you can get a concept of where we're going, where we've been with this. So the fetal life there in the first chunk, we went through birth, and then gradually we have that big hump in the first year of more testosterone with that flat area between ages, say, 1 and 9 years old. The childhood or juvenile pause phase. And then from ages usually 9 to 15 years old, you can see that the 9 to 15 years old, we get a huge increase up to like a 200% increase in testosterone from childhood up to age 15, which then starts to plateau a bit in age 30, 40, and then you can see from age 60 to 100, it gradually decreases. We think that different men are different, but 1 to 3% per year in males, the testosterone level goes down in the mature male brain. Okay, on the next slide, I wanted to go back to something we talked about briefly in terms of the boy and girl brain. Because that stage of life called childhood or the juvenile pause, there have been huge amounts of work. The person that's worked maybe the most on this in great detail is Eleanor Maccabee from Stanford. And she basically has coined a phrase of basically that boys and girls grow up in a different gender culture almost. We all know at this stage of science that the male and female have, of course, genetic differences, and then they have environmental differences, and then we also have cultural differences in terms of our expectations of behavior of that gender. So that's always, those things are all impacting on that little person. And so I wanted to talk about what's called kind of the typical gender-typical play behavior and toys and play styles that little boys and little girls will have in terms of Eleanor Maccabee's work and what she's observed in the preschool's age, which are kind of the 3 and 4 year olds. Okay, on the next slide, there's a type of play that many of you may have heard about or observed with your own kids or with boys called rough and tumble play. And boys all over the world in all cultures tend to do this much, much more than girls do. Girls will do a little bit of it and then they're done with it. But little boys will endlessly love to do rough and tumble play with each other. And this is not anything that someone taught them to do and girls not to do. However, of course, it may be a little more tolerated or encouraged in boys. So that's a cultural piece of that, and maybe discouraged a little bit more in girls. But even if you just leave them to their own devices, boys tend to like this rough and tumble play more than girls do. And even in, they look at it in primates, little primate males and females. The boy primates like to do more of the rough and tumble play than the little girls do. Okay, on the next slide, here's a toy example. And I put this slide in because I remember when my son was this age. And if any of you have kids you're in the grocery store and you're in the checkout line or you're wherever you are, you're at Target or you're at Walmart, someplace where they have lots of these little action figures. I must have endlessly bought these little action figures for my son at various times. He just adored these kinds of sort of male warrior action figures. And I can remember when he was about 4 years old, because I was very convinced. I mean, when I was at UC Berkeley, I can remember with my roommates, my female roommates in college, we would all talk about, you know what, when we have boys, you know, we are going to raise our boy. We're going to raise them with gender neutral toys. We're going to raise them to be gender neutral. And so, of course, when I had my son, he was number one child, so I figured I'm just going to give him dolls. I'll give him a variety of things that he chooses to play with. Of course, this is the type of thing he preferred, but I gave him a doll all wrapped up at Christmas in a box, and he tears open the paper and he grabs her by her torso, and he's already off and running. He's using her long legs as a spear. At that point, I thought, I guess not. I guess I've failed at trying to move him in that direction. So there was a lot of education for me, too, in just watching this toy preference that boys have. And boys, even the little primate males, they have more preference for things that are called wheeled toys. And the little female primates will choose the cuddly, soft play toys more frequently. So nobody's really taught them this toy preference. So here in this next slide, the little two girls talking to each other through their connection with their tin cans, just to represent the type of play as opposed to the rough and tumble play for the little boys. Little girls typically do this, what's called relationship play. So they will often assign roles. You be the mommy, I'll be the daddy. You be the doctor, I'll be the patient. And little boys will play like this with little girls as well, but they don't have much patience often for doing one go around this, and then they're off and running, come on guys, let's go get them, or they are often doing their own thing. Little girls can play these kinds of role assignment. They're called role assignment, role play types of play as a style of play that is more typical of little girls. Of course, if you look at the whole population of little girls and little boys, there's usually 1 out of 10 boys and 1 out of 10 girls that don't fit this model at all. So that's not an insignificant number. So it's important to realize that there are so many kids that don't fit what I'm telling you, but this is the bulk of the research in terms of what kind of the typical is, but not to forget about that 1 in 10 that's quite different or may prefer the other gender's way of play and toy choice. Okay, so I wanted to kind of move into some of the sex-specific behavior in children and kind of just review that for a minute, because I think it's important just to keep that in mind that adults don't usually teach children those kinds of behaviors. They don't teach them to choose those kinds of toys. We may give our boys the message that they shouldn't cry, they should kind of man up. There's a lot of kind of imposing a more masculine version of behavior on boys, and more maybe allowing for cuddly behavior or being comforted when little girls get hurt than little boys. So that's something that seems to be more true in all cultures, of the way we treat little girls and little boys and give them the message about what's okay and what's not okay. So let's keep that in mind as well, as part of the sex-specific behavior. So just to review boys, point number one, boys, they have more of the rough and tumble play. Second, girls have more of what we call the relationship role play. And finally, third point here on this slide is that gender non-conforming kids, that they may be genetically male, they may decide that they may be more interested in the relationship role play, and genetically female, but more interested in the rough and tumble play. There's a particular syndrome called congenital adrenal hyperplasia in both boys and girls. That is a syndrome where their adrenal glands make more testosterone. For boys, it doesn't seem to make, it's just kind of in the noise of their testosterone anyway. But for the girls who have congenital adrenal hyperplasia, they end up, of course, having more testosterone as a fetus in utero. Their own adrenal glands are making testosterone. And then as they are, after they're born, little girls and onward, they have more androgens, testosterone coming from their adrenal glands. Congenital adrenal hyperplasia, its short name is CAH. But just to give you that as one type of well-known example, and those girls have been researched for 30 years and followed from the time they were diagnosed as kids, all through adulthood, all through either motherhood. About one-third of those girls go on to have their own children. It seems about one-third of those girls, the genetically female girls that have congenital adrenal hyperplasia, are more interested in rough and tumble play. More of that population of girls becomes same-sex attracted in their teen years and end up choosing same-sex partners, and at least in the past, weren't as likely to have children. So it's very interesting to look at different populations based on what kind of hormones their brain and body were marinated in during the fetal life and then during childhood and, of course, in teen years. So just to keep that in mind. Okay, on our next slide, okay, so the final thing is that the research in this area is advancing. Okay, so just in summary, the child brain, first point is that 3 to 8 years, that's that hormonally quiet period that we call the juvenile pause. And then next point is that that girls play, we had that relationship role play, the boys had that superhero rough and tumble play, and then that kind of the gender neutral toys issue is something a lot of parents are concerned about, at least try to offer their kids that, but don't get too upset if they just want the action toys like my son did. Okay, next we're going to move on to, in the next slide, the teen girl brain and the teen boy brain, the rock and roll phase of life. I must say this is the time of life where I get parents asking me the most questions about what to do about various behaviors. Okay, so the next slide in kind of the teen brain, this little slide, these little boys are like 11, 12 years old. Who knows what they're looking at on that computer screen? That's maybe this is like the screen, the laptop computer, hopefully, that has the parental controls, but probably not. That's probably why they have those like rather guilty looks on their faces. But it's an interesting stage that boys, I think you guys out there versus you females out there or you moms out there, this stage of life for me as a mom that went through with a teen boy, even though I know all about the hormones and behavior, it was very interesting because when I was writing the female brain book, my son was about this age. He was just hitting puberty. He might have been like almost 12 and a half or 13. And I can remember driving him to the hamburger joint one day and saying to him, honey, you know, mom is writing this section of her book right now. And I know I wouldn't ordinarily ask you this questions or these questions, but you know, I was wondering what guys your age would say about, you know, the girls that come to school dressed in, you know, very skimpy clothes, I guess I put it that way, since we live in California and girls can dress however they want to come to class. And often that's in, you know, little halter tops or whatever that is. And he says, "Well, Mom, guys my age," he says with his kind of slightly cracking voice, "says, guys my age, Mom, well, it's sort of distracting because it's sort of hard not to look at them." And look at them, he meant look at the breasts. So that sort of stage. And I said, "Oh, really?" He says, "Yeah, Mom, you know, when you first start noticing that, first start looking at them like that," he says, "first of all, you kind of think for a while you're a perv or something." I said, "Oh, really?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, until you realize all the other guys are talking about the same thing." So it was interesting for me as a mom to realize that there's the sexual thoughts and the noticing of the female body parts that happens as the testosterone level goes up in these boys and turns on that area in the brain for sexual pursuit, that they are kind of very alone with that in the very beginning. They're not quite sure what's happening to them. I think that's something that's useful to keep in mind. At any rate, the next slide just as an example, it's a 25-fold increase in testosterone that's going on between ages 9 and 15. And let's see. The other thing about that, the testosterone increase, of course, at that time is that the average age for puberty for boys, for what we call the first wet dream, where the whole system is going to be activated, is about 13.5 years old, so 13 and a half. Is sort of that threshold for boys. Of course, we moms usually don't know about that. Probably the dads don't either. But that kind of means that the whole system is physiologically mature. Okay. Now for the girls, they're in the next slide. This is just, we're going to go back to this slide a bit and kind of look at this, because this is what's happening in the girls' system in terms of their hormones. If you look at this slide, and you look back where it says number one there, where it says one, and there's that little black area that says menses. So that little area there is when the menstrual cycle is happening, when you're bleeding in that first 4, 5, 6, 7 days of the cycle. And when you're counting the days of the menstrual cycle, day one of bleeding is day one. So some females bleed 4 days, 5 days, some bleed 7 days. So there's that first week can be menses. And you look at the estrogen slash E2. The E2 is the kind of the symbol we all use in medicine for the estrogen that the ovary makes. The ovary is pumping out all that estrogen. And at its peak there, it's going to trigger ovulation. Of course, the egg pops out of the ovary, comes down the fallopian tube, getting ready to end up ready to be fertilized if it meets any sperm. So at ovulation is the highest peak of estrogen, but also notice down there in the little black dotted line that looks like a black hill there is testosterone. Testosterone is also coming out of the ovary. The ovary is making a lot of testosterone during the cycle. So if you look at the highest point for testosterone in that, I say that that's the stage at which females have the highest sex drive. So that sex drive, of course, is going to be naturally, Mother Nature made it so that the sex drive would be the highest right at ovulation, so you have more chance to get pregnant. So that's the whole phase of what's going on in that first 2 weeks, and then you can see the little red dotted area, the progesterone that's going way up in that second, the last 2 weeks of the menstrual cycle, which happens after ovulation, because the little sac that the egg, the little sac that's holding that egg is called the corpus luteum, and that little sac, once the egg goes out, it starts to make that progesterone. So that progesterone is made by that little sac left behind, the little wrapping left behind in the ovary after the egg has already popped out, this progesterone, that it's going to prepare the whole body and the uterus for possible implantation of the egg. So there's the progesterone that's coming up in that little hill. So next point, if you just hit the little arrow on that on this slide, you'll see the PMS part of the menstrual cycle, which is where that progesterone starts to take a deep dive down there right at the end of the cycle. So that, if you're going to be a woman that has, about 80% of women know what PMS is or has had some of the irritability, easy crying, easily irritable, feeling just out of sorts for a couple of days. 20% of women don't get anything, but 80% know some of what happens, and some cycles are worse than others for that. So I sometimes treat couples and I just have them agree not to, don't have any big fights during those 2 days. Just try to chill out and have a discussion about whatever the issue is a couple days later. Anyway, so that's what's going on for the rock and roll of females during this stage of their lives. Okay, in the next slide, the teen girls are at this stage of life where they're trying to be fashionable, they're trying to, you know, their job and what's going on in their brain, where the male's going on to the sexual pursuit area that's being triggered by all his testosterone, girls are wanting to make themselves attractive to boys. They are trying to, if you will, lure the boys or be attractive to be chosen by the boys. So that's part of what's going on in their hollow brain circuit with their hormonal triggering of the female brain circuits. Okay, the next slide shows you that how that estrogen starts to go up about 15-fold in increase in girls. By about age 13, it's way up there, and of course in the adult females, we're all way to the top. Okay, the next slide. Just wanted to review the teen brain being under construction and why that matters. And this is a phrase that I'm sure a lot of you have been hearing about over the last number of years, about the teen brain being under construction, because the first big stage of brain development is in utero in the fetus, and the next big stage of development is 0 to 3 years old. Then it's pretty quiet through the childhood stage, and then all of a sudden the third big major time of brain reconstruction is in the teen brain. Okay, in the next slide, the main issue that we think about, we need to know about in society, is that the planning center, that prefrontal cortex of the brain, which is right behind your forehead, is an area that allows us to predict the risks and benefits of things, to predict and to plan. Say, if I don't get an A on this test, I know that I won't get the GPA I want, and so that the whole planning part of the brain, or if I take this skateboard and I go down this, I might fall and you know, crack my head open, you know, just assessing risks. That area of the brain, when you're an adult, it's functioning full tilt. But when you're a teen, that area is still very much under construction. Okay, in our next slide, the planning of that prefrontal cortex, just to review, it's where planning, organization, for the first point on this slide, is that complex thinking, assessing risks and benefits and consequences of behavior, then also the delayed gratification, future-oriented goals, goal-directed behavior, and control of our impulses all occur there, and it is not finished yet in the teen brain. Next point is that the reason that adults act like adults or adult-like behavior is because we can use our prefrontal cortex to process the information and make well-reasoned decisions. Obviously, some of us do that better than others, but at least theoretically, adults have that part of their brain pretty well wired and have the ability at least to think through something before they do it. Teens don't have all of those synapses pruned and reinforced in that area of their brain. And typically, that doesn't happen until the early 20s. It's a little bit different in girls and boys. So then the next slide, the teen brain being under construction. If you really want to do a deep dive into who's been doing this research for the longest period of time, is a key study by Jay Geed, And the first point in this next slide, he's at the NIMH, he scanned the brains of 145 children from ages 3 to 22 and has followed their brain development, discovering that that teen brain is still a massive architectural reconstruction project, if you will. Next point on that slide is the area like the prefrontal cortex and then the amygdala. And talk specifically about the amygdala, but it's a little almond-shaped area. If you just put your fingers in right above your ears, if you were able to just smoosh those right into your brain, they're about the size of an almond on both sides. The amygdala is that area you've probably heard about. Like, it's basically the where the biggest kind of like emotional things like fear, fear, anxiety, etc., are triggered in that area. And if that area is fully lit up in your amygdala, it's very hard to use the rest of your brain because you're in a like fight or flight situation. But the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex start to be hooked up by about ages 10 to 11 in girls, ages 13 and 15 in boys when these start to be hooked up, and not finished being hooked up in boys until actually 19 to 22 and girls 16 to 17. So I kind of think that the construction of the female brain is kind of in its mostly adult form in females, but by about 19, you can say that it's pretty much there, 18 or 19. In boys, probably not until 21, 22. So there is a bit of a difference, and I don't think in society we probably take enough notice of that. All of us probably have experienced that in our own lives. So the last point on this slide, the bottom line is that teen brains won't be thinking logically or rationally until they reach their early 20s. Think rental car agencies. Rental car agencies used to always have that limit before recently that 25 years old was the age you could rent one of their cars. And somehow they knew that like they were in a zone where they could expect rational behavior, adult behavior by the age of 25. Okay, into the next section about teen girl brains, hormones, and emotions. Teen girls, the hormone surges start about 8 to 10 years old. The gradual awakening of the ovaries starts to happen. Remember, the brain and the pituitary start flashing down to the ovaries saying, time to wake up and make some estrogen, which sort of creates more and more estrogen. The fourth point here, estrogen acts on the hypothalamus and initiates the menstrual cycle by about age 12. Of course, that's different in different ethnicities, and we'll go over that in just a minute. But the fifth point here on this slide is the surges of emotion and mood that accompany that onset of the fluctuating hormones and have a greater, females have a greater reaction to stress because of the fluctuating hormones through the menstrual cycle. So there's something about the female brain being tuned, like almost like a musical instrument, it's getting tuned to be able to react more sensitively to emotions. Now, also to stress. And this is a big area of difference in the male and female that's just really starting to be understood by scientists about how that is, why that is. Anthropologists feel that the reason the female brain gets tuned this way as soon as it gets to its fertile age is so that it can be tuned more to the emotional sensitivities to a helpless nonverbal infant, and helping keep helpless infants alive is the reason for this like emotional tuning and stress sensitivity the female brain gets during this age. Okay, the last point on this slide is that there ends up being, as a consequence, about a 2-to-1 female to male ratio of mood disorders. So in all cultures studied, about 2-to-1 females have more anxiety, depression than males. Of course, in my field, that's the bulk of people, of women who come through my clinic at different ages, since I treat mood disorders. Okay, on the next slide, I just think it's important to know the difference in age of onset of puberty and menstruation, and in the different ethnicities I think it's helpful, especially for people who are in the educational field. The onset of breast development only happens, you know, you can see the little girls with just the little breast buds that start to form. The only reason that starts to form like that is because of estrogen. And you'll notice that also in boys in puberty. Some boys get quite a lot of breast development. That's because he's the testosterone in his body that he's making huge amounts of. But some of it also gets converted by the fat cells into estrogen. So he may get some breast development as well. But little girls usually start getting breast development. On average, Caucasian girls by their 10th birthday. African American girls by their 9th birthday. You see breast bud development in a little girl, you can usually say within the next 2 years she'll probably have her first period. So menarche means the age of onset of menstruation. Caucasian girls average age is 12.6 and African American girls 12.1. So it's a little younger for African American girls. And if you look at also Asian girls end up being something more like 13.1. So they're a little later. Hispanic girls end up being somewhere in the Caucasian range as well. So we don't know why there are these differences. Some people say it has to do with the basic amount of body fat genetically that different ethnicities carry, and that's allowing the brain to go into puberty earlier for those girls because they have more body fat, and the brain won't let you start menstruating until you have enough body fat because doesn't want to waste any extra energy on possible, if it's not going to be able to be a pregnancy, you don't want to waste ovulation and energy on ovulating if there's not going to be the chance of having enough body fat to support a pregnancy. So full breast development, Caucasian girls is about 15 and a half, African American girls is about 13.9. So this is out of the big, what's called the NHANES PROS study that was done up till about 2006. So this was the largest one in the United States that was done in recent decades. Next slide is back to the menstrual cycle and the brain. Remember, we reviewed how that estrogen peak goes up. Sleep is very much increased. You see where sleep is increased in the progesterone hill down there. And if you push the next button, you'll see that the verbal abilities for girls are at their peak a couple of days when the estrogen is high. The verbal abilities are there. And the next piece is that sexual increase in sex, interest in sex is right in that top hill of the testosterone right before ovulation. So just to review how that menstrual cycle hormones and behavior or different urges in the different weeks of the menstrual cycle based on the hormones. And then here at the very end is PMS, is greater in those last couple of days, or for some females, the last week of the menstrual cycle. Okay. Our next slide, I just wanted to indicate, since this is what I do a lot in my clinic, the best mood, in terms of the mood in the menstrual cycle, the best mood is also in that week right before ovulation, and the worst mood tends to be that week right before the menstrual cycle, especially for women that tend to be, what we say, a little bit more moody or anxious. Okay, next slide is the risk for depression by age and sex, which I think gets back to that issue of the 0 to 4, of course, and 5 to 9. It says males are in the blue or turquoise, the lower graph, and the females are in the upper one. So really, depression and anxiety in boys and girls is about a 1-to-1 ratio. But then something happens when menses, you can see there, when after menses starts, somewhere between 10 and 14, depression and anxiety in girls takes off, going up to that 2-to-1 ratio. Of course, that females have postpartum and perimenopause, things we'll talk about in a while, having a lot of issues with hormonal fluctuations, making the female brain a little more predisposed to mood and anxiety disorders. Okay, in the next slide, the emotional pain of social loss, I think that this is an interesting part of how the female brain and also the male brain is being tuned to kind of use the, what's called the human sadness system starts to develop a lot during the teen restructuring of the brain. And so this is just showing the whole sadness system of how it's being increased in size, increase in activation, and basically it's very important for social interactions to be able to bond and attach to your peers, boyfriend, girlfriend, significant others, and the whole aspects of getting attached to the social life that you are going to grow up and be a part of outside of your family. So just to say that that whole system is being developed and reinforced during these hormonal fluctuations of teen girls. The next slide, thinking about estrogen and oxytocin in girls, because, you know, oxytocin is stimulated also by all that estrogen. And oxytocin, we often call it as the love hormone. It's the hormone that's released. If you do this, if you pet your own hand or you pet the head of a beloved one, or they pet you in that nice, like what's called 20 cycles per second, a certain slow kind of petting motion, it releases in our body, or gentle massage, that it releases oxytocin in our bodies and brains. The oxytocin is also, of course, in females, it's what causes the uterus to squeeze out the baby. So it's used in females for labor and delivery as well, and also for squeezing out the milk in breastfeeding. So it's a very important hormone. It's both present in males and females, but more in females since estrogen really stimulates it. So first point in this slide is that also girls get a lot of this oxytocin release by interactions that they have with others. And this, I'm saying that she wants to talk with her mother about her worries and she wants to be held and comforted. She needs that calming effect of bonding and comforting that's associated with the oxytocin surge. You know, I can remember my son in his teen years, in his early teen years, he would still, you know, kind of, he would occasionally sit on my lap. He'd let me do a little bit of this, but it wasn't like he wasn't coming to me with all his worries and wasn't necessarily wanting to be petted and held so much. But teenage girls tend to do this more definitely than boys do. Of course, then you've got another side of teen girls in interaction with their mothers. But next point on this one is that oxytocin is called the bonding hormone. And it gets released during hugs and petting and intimate interactions. Third on this point is that teen girls get a real biological comfort from talking and talking through their worries and being held and comforted. And fourth point in here is that high estrogen leads to high oxytocin and a lot of satisfaction from social bonding. Girls in puberty need to really feel connected. And girls in the puberty feel, they especially in a very in a developmental stage where they can feel very estranged by cliques and mean girls. So that whole social interaction of pain and suffering that girls go through, boys of course do it in a different way. Okay, in our next slide, I just wanted to go back to not leaving the boys out since they have their own issues at this stage. And you know, the testicles are producing all of that testosterone we talked about. That 20-fold increase in testosterone surges leads to the brain and developing into more brain, male brain circuits, area sexual pursuit. The voice deepens. It causes the penis to elongate and thicken, and the visual circuits to start focusing on female body parts. I told you about the tips that my son gave me about how it also feels a little bit shocking to start looking and focusing so much on girls' body parts, but like breasts and buttocks and the female curvaceous figures, which is all very normal. The boys very quickly realize that all other guys are in this same bucket with them. Okay, and our next slide, let's see, is hang on for just a second. I think I got the rolling ball here on my screen. Okay, so I guess we're gonna have to look at this guy for a minute until my Michael, are you there? Yeah, okay. I just got my unfortunately my PowerPoint decided to go with the little rolling ball here for some reason. Don't know why it decided to have a fit here, but it will probably do something that it's doing. So let's also just talk about that whole stage for males. And you know, I think one of the things that we know very much about girls focus a lot on their body parts not being like either their breasts are too little, they're too flat, they're too big, they're too whatever. So boys also get very focused. I think we females don't realize enough that boys get quite focused sometimes on what's happening to them, and they don't think necessarily that they're adequately muscular enough, or that their genitals aren't large enough or developing enough. So there's a lot of real uncertainty in boys as well that I think is not necessarily appreciated in society as much, certainly, as it could be. And so I'm going to try to get my. I don't want to lose all of you guys just because my PowerPoint thing is giving me a fit here. So sorry about that, Michael. It's not being very happy here. If I did lose you and have to reboot, unfortunately, it's going to cut off my whole Skype session, isn't it? Which I apologize for. Do you have any suggestions, Michael, on what I might do? Just because I'm getting this circular ball for some reason. Okay. Let's see. Is there a way that you can show them to me, or I just can't see them because I can't see any of mine except for this one with this poor guy looking at his towel. Okay. And that's that graph. Okay. So that's the in the male lifespan. Okay, let me just see. I'm trying to figure out why I'm not being able to. Okay, it's not going to stop at the moment. Okay, sure, we can do that, definitely. So I just wanted to summarize going through sort of what we've been through already, which is to take the female and male brain from the moment of conception, where that sperm meets the egg, and starts the whole system going for in the male, the tiny testicles that are going to marinate the entire brain and body to make male, and female being left unperturbed by testosterone, and then popping out as either being male brain circuits, female brain circuits and body through the childhood phase, where we basically have a lot of behavioral, both gender specific ways in which the culture starts to impact and how we train our boys and girls to be different, but also how their own systems have already been sort of built as a template as they go into the teen years with the rock and roll of puberty happening. And start to trigger those already laid down in the fetal brain, the area for sexual pursuit in the male, and wanting to be attractive to males that females do. So, of course, as we get to the early part of starting to have the mating game starting to be played in females and males at that stage, and what the version of what we think of as what we're going to want for getting into choosing a mate to maybe have children with or not, that's a whole different phase of getting into what might be females' desire to control their fertility, and males basically having a lot of more capacity than, of course, we give them credit for in the daddy brain. When he is sleeping with his pregnant spouse, we also know that he gets a lot of his testosterone is suppressed, and he gets another hormone that really gets increased called prolactin, which is called sometimes the parenting hormone. So the daddy brain really goes through some changes, and evolutionary psychologists think this is to try and keep the male closer to home while the female is nursing, pregnant, and helping raise the children. And so that's a very important part of the daddy brain that gets formed. At that stage, females, of course, have all of the oxytocin, breastfeeding, bonding with the baby that's really very hardwired in the female brain and body to try and help us keep helpless infants alive. So I hope this has been a kind of a helpful overview of what happens in the male and female brain as we kind of get set up to go through our lives. And I was wondering if any of you have any questions, we can go a deeper dive into some of those about any part of this or even other parts that I didn't bring up.
Yes, Dr. Brizendine, we've got lots of questions here, and I want to start with something that we were touching on just a little bit before we went live, and that was the question of what research tells us about the wiring in the brain of someone with gender dysphoria. Also, a question that comes from Cheryl along those lines is, what about transgender brain, lesbian or gay brain, asexual brain, etc.?
Great question. And so in the appendix of both the male and female brain, I have a whole section in both of those on gay female brain, gay male brain, that will give anybody who wants to do a really deeper dive into that. But let's go back. Remember, we talked about the different possibilities genetically that you might end up with the Y chromosome, say, being introduced into the egg and ending up with genetically a male fetus, but could have a mutation that makes it so that the receptors on all the cells do not respond to testosterone. That would mean that the body parts and the brain parts actually don't develop in the male direction. They instead develop in the female direction. So actually, that individual may be growing up basically will grow up looking female, because the genitals end up being female, the brain ends up being female, and they look very female until, of course, puberty, and then things don't quite unfold for them in that direction. And so then usually these individuals come to the endocrinologist or the pediatric endocrinologist and start getting worked up and discovering that maybe that they have some infertility, because they actually are they feel and have been raised as female, but they are genetically male. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this is an example of a category that we know about. It's called androgen insufficiency or androgen insufficiency or a mutated androgen receptor. So another example that's in the other direction is, let's say that sperm was carrying an X and the fetus ends up being female genetically, XX, but there's all of this testosterone from, let's say, her adrenal glands or from some other source, lots of testosterone that marinates that otherwise genetically female fetus. She will be born with lots of male brain circuits, some what's called masculinization of the genitals. So sometimes the clitoris is so long that at birth it looks like a small penis, and those girls in the past were often, the parents were told they had a boy, and they often were raised as boys. But clearly they have a mixture of things, and they can grow up in different ways, feeling very much more comfortable at being male identified, even though their genetics are XX. So you can see how you can get, and those are the ones that we know about. There, we believe that there are many other ways where you can be basically have a male body but a female brain, or the opposite, where you have basically everything is male but you feel female. And this issue of gender dysphoria, that's what we kind of call it. Gender dysphoria usually comes nowadays, thank goodness, the parents bring these situations very much earlier now to the pediatrician, and the behavioral pediatricians are very, very good these days at working with parents and working with families that have a child that by the age, sometimes as young as 3, 4, 5 in that age group, have what's called gender dysphoria. They are, their genitals may be female, but they're convinced that they're male. Or they may have male genitals and they're convinced that they're female. They want to dress in girls' clothes. And that tends to be the one that's a little, we've actually, not surprisingly, found that the male who wants, that feels like he is female at 3 or 4 or 5, is that type of gender dysphoria. It's a little bit harder for fathers to swallow, actually. And so oftentimes it's mothers who end up bringing those children to the pediatrician. And then it's a whole lot of family therapy that's needed to try and just go with that child. Lots of children may have a stage they go through where they want to be the other sex. And you don't want to push them in either direction. You want to let them unfold in whatever direction they are. So there's a very great center over in Oakland, California that specializes in this. There's centers all over the country now that specialize in children that have gender dysphoria, thank goodness. So there are places to get some help. And it's not a definite track for any kid. It's just a place where families can go to be listened to.
Now, this question is kind of overlaps very much with what you were just saying, and I wonder if you have any more to say about it. It comes from an anonymous viewer who writes, "Where do intersex people fit into this? When intersex people's genders are frequently designated at birth based on what you were talking about, fairly arbitrary standards of genital length."
Right. So, what used to happen, and what happens now? So what happens now if what's called, if a baby is born and they have something what's called genital ambiguity. In other words, sometimes the labia are puffy and they can kind of look like testicles, and the clitoris can be very long, kind of looks like a penis. And so that's called genital ambiguity. And any time you have a child that's where it's not very clear, what's done now is immediately that you basically, part of the blood testing and things that they do at that stage, they do genetic testing. So they want to find out whether that child is genetically male or genetically female. Now, that's not the end of the story, but that's now the beginning of the story. In the old days, they would just look at what's called genital ambiguity, and usually they would say, okay, we're going to raise this child as a male, which that didn't go, that was not clearly, that was not very helpful, because you didn't let the child grow up in whatever kind of, I mean, the intersex, allowing a child to grow up and choose the mixture of gender ways that they wanted to be is what you're able to do with, at least in lots of centers around the country, where you have a kid who's not sort of following the usual typical heterosexual direction of unfolding. So that's, I mean, that, I'm sorry, maybe I lost the questioner's point there. Is that what they wanted to know, or they wanted to know more about the biology of that, or the sexuality?
The question was just, where do intersex people fit into this? So however you were choosing to speak to that.
Right, yeah. So, mm-hmm. I mean, intersex people that's all the whole spectrum. And I think that you can see that the understanding of the science and biology and the specificity of what each, say, intersex person has, or what gender dysphoria, you know, whatever place you kind of enter into the medical profession trying to help you understand what your child has or doesn't have, and try to allow for them to develop as the most well-adjusted, happy human being they have a right to be is more the attitude of most medical professionals these days. So that's kind of, even though we don't necessarily know specifically what the genetics is or what the genetic mutation is, or if there even is one, or what the hormonal differences were at a certain stage of development, or even what the cultural and social parts of that were. So it's an evolving area that's really any of you out there in the audience who want to do more research in this area and do more studies, it's really, really very, very needed.
Mm-hmm. Sam writes, given the divorce rates in this hookup culture, the popular thinking is that men aren't wired for monogamy. Can you talk more about the hormones that are responsible for monogamy?
Thanks, Sam, for that question. That's a whole field of study now, actually. I was talking earlier about these little 5% of mammals that are monogamous, and that there's the genetics of monogamy in those have sort of been worked out, since the little vole is a little animal that bonds for life and is monogamous and helps the female raise the pups. And then they have a cousin called the Montane Vole, who he's kind of a hit-and-run guy. So he impregnates and he's out of there. He never even meets the pups. He's not part of that. And they're very, very genetically similar. One's called the Montane Vole, and one's the Prairie Vole. The Prairie Vole is the monogamous one. So they've looked at these genes to try and understand the genetics of monogamy, and have found that the vasopressin receptor gene is the gene where there's a big difference between these two very closely related animals. And in humans, there's about 17 different versions of that gene. So the female scientist I know joke, well, we should definitely measure every guy's vasopressin receptor gene before we decide to get married. So I think, Sam, your question is an interesting one about that issue of monogamy and genetics of monogamy. And there's a lot of studies that have looked at the fathers of males, if they're monogamous or not. If they're not monogamous and have had many affairs, the chances that the son is going to be very different is also a possibility, that they're genetically more related. So whether it's genes or environment, it's obviously a little bit of both.
Carol writes, what's your perspective of hormone replacement therapy for women and possibly men as we age?
Great question, because, you know, there's a lot of controversy about that since the big Women's Health Initiative of 2002 that came out, that followed lots of women that were on hormone replacement and not, and some of that study has sort of been debunked because of the different categories that were not very carefully looked at, and the average age was, you know, between 64 and 74. So it's felt that the women that were younger, as you go through menopause, the average age is 51.5. So there's a lot of room between that and 64 to get hormone replacement. So if you do not have a personal history of breast cancer, or you do not have the breast cancer genes that you have personally, or have had a personal history of breast cancer, the thinking now amongst my colleagues at UCSF in both the OBGYN and other departments is that, and if you're suffering a lot from hot flashes, is that those women deserve to be able to have hormone replacement for both their bones, their brain, their hot flashes, their sleep, all of those kinds of things. Lots of men, of course, you know, you've probably all seen these ads that that have been around for a long time, like, are you a low T guy? Do you have low T, low testosterone? Then you should get and increasing your testosterone by getting testosterone injections or pills or creams and gels. Well, that's not the bulk of medical profession that wants to necessarily give all that back, because there's, you know, some males may have a bigger increase in prostate cancer if they already have it. It doesn't cause prostate cancer, but it might ignite it if it's already there. So the jury is still out in medicine about whether hormone replacement in aging people, i.e. over the age of 50 or 60, is a good thing or a bad thing. One thing that we know is that it probably does not cause cancers, which we used to think that it did, but it basically can make, if you do get a cancer, it can make it grow faster, which is not a good thing either. So you have to work very individually with your doctors. I think that in lots of people, it can be a very helpful thing if you are very low. We've had lots of males that come through my colleague's clinic who are very low in testosterone. Their libido is very flat, and it's been something that's been helpful for them. So I think it's a real individual basis kind of thing. So thanks for that question.
And so just to tack on to that, if we are predisposed to certain types of cancers, and that's also something to watch for. Is that what you're saying as well?
Yes. Well, that's before you get started on any hormone therapy, you should definitely have a full medical workup and talk about your family history about what people in your family died from, and then that will give you some indication to what your own genes may have in store for you as you get older. So your doctor may say, well, because your family history is this and we've tested your genes and you have this gene, I would not recommend that you take estrogen or testosterone. And that's a small part of the population, but you know, some hormone replacement therapy as you age in populations that don't have that could indeed be very helpful.
Dr. Brizendine, we have time for one more question. And this one comes from Jing, and it looks like it is related to The Female Brain, your book. And she writes, how can learning about our inherited nervous system environment help us better understand ourselves? And can you also explain to viewers who might not be familiar with your book what the nervous system environment is?
Is that Jane that asked that question?
Yes, Jane.
Yes. Thanks, Jane, for that question. So was she called it the inherited nervous system or the?
The nervous system environment.
Oh, the nervous system environment. So I'm trying to understand exactly what she means by that. I mean, your nervous system environment, the nervous system environment that's marinated by certain hormones, or like we look at the female menstrual cycle, how it's on a different waves at different times of the month, your nervous system environment changes if you're female every 24 hours during your fertile years of the menstrual cycle. Males have an annual cycle where they have higher testosterone in kind of the December, in the winter months. They think that's because the good time to get pregnant is in January, February, so the babies are born December, January, February, so babies are born in the fall at the harvest season. And you look at the southern hemisphere and it's kind of the opposite. So babies have needed, anyway, that's the hypothesis about why males' testosterone levels tends to be higher around Christmas time. So that the nervous system environment of your hormones obviously matters, and it matters for our behavior and how you can have insight. I think particularly for females to have insight into their hormonal fluctuations and how they may be influencing your mood and your behavior and your thinking, your libido, your sleep, your verbal abilities. Just when you're at your best and when you're not at your best, I think what's very cool about just embracing that and knowing that about yourself personally is it allows you to be really kind and helpful to yourself, to not be expecting yourself to be at your best or do certain things maybe the couple days of the month where you're not feeling at your best physically because you're right, you're at that PMS period or you're at your lowest energy level. And then during that week or two when you're at your best energy level, I mean, it's sort of unrealistic to think we can plan our whole life around that. But I think it's just good to have that ability to reflect on that for ourselves to help us be at our best and to understand when we're not at our best, to forgive ourselves a little bit for it not being like about who we really are, but it may be a part of just our hormonal state of our nervous system.
Dr. Brizendine, thank you so very much. We are at time. We couldn't get to all of the questions, but we really appreciate the ones that you were able to address for us.
Thank you all very much. It's been nice to be with your audience.
This concludes the 12th live session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. Once again, I'd like to express our deep gratitude for Dr. Luann Brizendine for this outstanding presentation. Please note, the recording of this session will remain accessible for free for 24 hours. And if you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, to transcripts from each session, along with bonus gifts from our presenters. I'd also like to thank everyone who joined us tonight. We certainly appreciated your participation as well as the questions that you submitted. Please join us for our next live session with Locke Kelly, and that's going to take place tomorrow on March 26, 2017 at 12 p.m. Eastern Time. For Sounds True, I'm Christy Peoples. Thank you so very much for joining us. SoundsTrue.com, many voices, one journey.